Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
We're joined now by David Horgan, Managing Director of Petrol Resources. David, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The oil price is trading around the highest level it's been in 3 years. And part of it is what's been going on at OPEC, where they've been unable to agree on boosting production, basically. What's the nature of the disagreement that's going on?
Well, basically, OPEC has been spectacularly successful at recovering the oil price and cutting production. They cut 10 million barrels or 10% out of the market last year. Remember the situation with COVID. There was a sudden collapse in demand, as much as 30% due to destocking, as much as actual falling consumption. And the players got into a price war in early 2020, and the price collapsed. In the United States, it actually went negative for one contract for May delivery. Imagine that. Like, in theory, the oil price was actually negative. So OPEC then did a deal, including Russia, a very hard deal. Like, they took 10 million barrels out of the market, the most they've ever done. And amazingly, they've been able to maintain discipline. Basically, the Saudis were able to control the smaller Arab countries like United Arab Emirates, who is now causing them problems. And the Russians were able to control certain countries like Algeria and the stands. However, now that the international demand is resurging very strongly, it's within 3% of back to pre-COVID levels. Now there's the issue of how to roll back production. And they had a plan of bringing back 2% of world supply over 4 months. But the United Arab Emirates is protesting that its baseline is too low. It says that its capacity is higher than previously assumed, and it demands a readjustment to the formulae. And that's the disagreement.
They basically want to be able to put more oil because there's a boom coming.
Yeah. This is always a problem with the cartel. And the OPEC cartel is a particularly difficult one because, first of all, it only controls 40% of supply, which is a relatively modest cartel. Secondly, it's a particularly diverse cartel. If you think of all the players in it, you've got Iran versus Saudi Arabia. Venezuela is very different to a Muslim country. And they have so many different interests and different populations and different poverty levels that it's very difficult to get everyone to get on side. But they found in recent years, in 2014, again in 2018, and with COVID 2020, that you're far better off hanging together than hanging separately. But the big difference this time, and the reason why they've been able to maintain discipline so perfectly, is the involvement for the first time of the Russians. The Russians have always encouraged the others to cut production. Dating back to Soviet times, they always sent big delegations to Vienna conferences. They always encouraged cuts. And then as soon as the others had cut, the Russians always increased their production. This is the first time that the Russians have agreed to cut and actually honor the cuts. And a lot of people, like even the great Chris Weaver, you know, the Irish expert on Russia living in Moscow, he doubted that Putin would be able to get the Russian companies to discipline their output. But whatever Putin did, it worked perfectly. And the result is that they actually cut by more than they'd agreed. The Saudis cut an extra almost million barrels last September. However, they've now got the problem of rolling back production, and all the suppressed rows that were there for the past year are now bouncing back to the surface. But in a way, it's a good problem for them to have because it's driven by strong demand. But the financial markets don't know how to react. And you saw all sorts of schizophrenic reactions from Wall Street. Normally, when there's rows in OPEC, normally it means that they're going to overproduce and that's going to lead to a collapse in the oil price and better deals for buyers in the West. However, in a rising market where there are supply shortages, at least in the short run, any uncertainty normally translates into higher and jittery prices. And it's those two conflicting forces that are confusing the markets as we speak.
Well, it's a very interesting story. I mean, what do you think is going to happen? My own instinct, David, just from looking at the coverage, is people seem to think this is going to get sorted out relatively quickly. What's your view?
Yeah, I think what there's been the last 10 years for OPEC plus Russia has been an expensive lesson in the benefits of a cartel. I mean, basically, if you look at it from the Russian point of view, the Russians have cut about, 12% of their output, and they've doubled the price. You know, so anyone can work out those sums in their head. And while they would like to cheat their neighbors, they all know that they're in it together. And also the control of data within OPEC is so good now that everyone knows where every cargo is coming from, even when it's being smuggled. So it's relatively difficult now to cheat. But the big difference from, say, 10 years ago is the role of Vladimir Putin. Putin has played really a masterful chess game over the last 10 years. He intervened militarily in Syria, not by getting caught in a quagmire like the Americans in Afghanistan, but he intervened enough to stop the Saudis imposing a jihadi regime in Syria. And the Saudis are also bogged down in Yemen. And at the same time, he managed to kiss and make up with the elderly Saudi king, who actually went to Moscow in 2017, first time that's ever happened, and the headstrong Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who's only 35 and has caused such chaos in the oil markets and in the wars in the region, for whatever reason, has seen sense and has now established an apparently very good relationship with Vladimir Putin. So once again, the master chess player has got his way.
So do you think this alliance between Russia and the Saudis is going to get the UAE to cave and get this deal done?
Yeah, I mean the UAE has developed its own sort of peculiar independent foreign policy. You've seen that in Libya and to some extent in Syria. You've also seen UAE being one of the countries that has done a peace deal with Israel. And it's hard to know how much the Saudis approve or disapprove of that. There are limits how far you can push them, because if you look at the example of Qatar, the Qataris, who are mainly a liquefied natural gas exporter rather than a crude exporter, they actually left OPEC because they got so peeved by being pushed around by the Saudis that they actually left OPEC. But the UAE is in a different situation. It's much more exposed to Saudi Arabia, and it's much more of a oil exporter, produces about 3 million barrels a day. So in the end, a little bit of pressure and a little bit of reasonableness, a bit of camel trading. And what they'll probably do is they will recognize that the current quotas are a bit harsh on the UAE, and everyone will kiss and make up and decide that they're better hanging together than hanging separately.
Our guest here on News Talk is David Horgan, Managing Director of Petrol Resources. Is it fair to say, you know, even with pumping more oil, which we're expecting, the oil price is still going to go up? Given where demand is, I mean, what's your expectation, David, over the next few months as to where we might go?
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming about a 10% increase in the crude oil price over the next months. And there could always be a wild card. I mean, there could always be like what happened a year ago with a crazy price war. But even a crazy price war will only be temporary, because the common interest will push them into some sort of accommodation. But the underlying problem is that since 2014, there's been a virtual investor strike in the oil industry. And at a minimum, there's been $5 trillion of investment that has not been made.
And this is because of climate change concerns.
Yeah, well, it's a number of things. One, the oil price crashed in November 2014, and there was the first of the price wars, which went on for 2 years. I mean, they had a deal after 1 year, but then there was a flaming row between Mohammed bin Salman and the Iranians. That led to them storming out of the meeting. It took another year for the Algerians and Venezuelans to get them back into bed together. And then there was another row in 2018 and another row with COVID. Because the oil price was low, the national oil companies basically delayed necessary investment. And then you've the problem of the harassment of the Western oil companies by various governments like the EU and now Joe Biden, and the NGOs turning up at your AGM and roaring, shouting, embarrassing the executives. So that the executives at the moment, especially of companies like BP, Shell and Total Energy, they're doing their best to pretend to be doing the right thing. And they talk about net zero, which of course is a nonsense in a business that is producing oil and gas. But they're playing the game. But part of the way they're playing the game is by trying to flog their dirty assets like tar sands in Canada and the expensive fracking assets that they bought at a very high price. And they're saying that they're not going to explore in new basins. They're just going to focus on existing basins. And then there's countries like Ireland that bizarrely have just effectively banned the whole industry. So on the one hand, you've got a dramatic cutback in exploration and even development of necessary projects. On the other hand, you've got a dramatic surge in demand, particularly in Asia. And the two can't go together. So What we'll find is in the coming years, certainly next 10, 15 years, there's going to be critical shortages of oil, which will lead to even faster growth in natural gas and probably a continued life for coal. The anticipated gradual ramp down of coal in electricity generation in China and India will probably be delayed by maybe 15, 20 years, and you'll find more emissions. So the paradoxical consequence of the IPCC and the green parties of the world policies will probably lead to higher emissions, because people will be bringing oil and gas from greater distances, producing it in dirtier places, and burning more coal.
Well, we'll wait and see how that works out. I mean, I see your point, all right. But I think what you're saying, David, without saying it in the words in which it's often said, is you're telling me we've passed peak oil.
Well, depends what you mean by peak oil. If you mean conventional onshore oil, we peaked in 2001. But there's also been a miracle, which the peak oil theorists have completely missed. Over the last 15 years, there has been a number of leaps forward in technology fueled by speculative funding out of Wall Street. And these are collectively called fracking. Now, there's no one technology. Part of fracking is directional drilling, which is much more targeted. Part of it is three-dimensional seismic, which is like an X-ray or an MRI scan only under the rocks. And part of it is the development of new processes, like putting detergent, in some cases acid, under high pressure with granular sand into very tight reservoirs, and then enabling these reservoirs to produce gas and light oil. And that has the effect of effectively quadrupling the available resource. Now, that resource needs higher prices than conventional oil, but the technology has now been invented. It's like nuclear weapons. Once you invent fracking technology, you can't uninvent it. And if prices stay high enough for long enough, you'll see probably fracking extended to Argentina, Southern Africa, Eastern Europe. It probably won't be allowed in Western Europe because of the agitation of the environmentalists. But the net effect of fracking technologies and tar sands and deep water drilling is to dramatically increase the available oil. So one of the great ironies of recent years has been that we've effectively quadrupled the resource available to the oil industry.
Well, we'll see if the demand is there to actually consume all this, given some of the factors we've been talking about. I want to ask you about the Americans, David, because the sector there was really hurt very badly last year with the collapse in oil demand. What's going on there at the moment?
Yeah, well, America is a fascinating story. You can never underestimate the American genius for innovation and risk-taking. Basically, the United States had dominated oil until the 1960s. It was two-thirds of world reserves. It was most of production. It basically won World War I, and indeed, you could argue certainly World War II and possibly World War I. So the Americans really dominated the industry. But in 1970, exactly the phenomenon that you described happened. They hit a peak and went into rapid decline. And that's why American companies expanded rapidly into places like Venezuela and Iraq, Kuwait, Iran, Saudi Arabia. So the United States production collapsed. About 15 years ago, it reached a low point of about 5.5 million barrels a day. But then the concerns came about 9/11 and the clash of civilizations. They didn't want to be dependent on Iraq and Iran and Africa. And there was a flood of interest in these technologies that we described, the hydraulic fracturing technologies. Now, partly it was things that were happening anyway for deep water drilling, and partly it was the pure innovative ability of individual American entrepreneurs, some of them Irish-American, like the Cullens of Quintana. They started experimenting with higher pressure pumps because nobody made a high pressure pump. And they experimented, really, these Irish-American guys in a garage, and they went to 30,000 PSI. A few pumps exploded, nobody got killed. Then they mastered how to get the raw materials to make it more safe. And as these technologies were experimented on in their own tracks, the word got around through the gossipy network, through service companies like Halliburton and Baker Hughes. And then their neighbors started copying them. People got poached or left or sold their technology or sold their companies. Then the majors started copying this to the point that the United States actually 2 years ago, it reached about 17 million barrels. So from 5.5 in 15 years to 17.5. It was almost self-sufficient because American demand was about 20 million. But a lot of the capital that was fueling this was speculative capital from China, from elsewhere. And a lot of the people investing didn't understand that you needed quite high prices for the fracking wells to be profitable. All the wells seemed to make money if you looked at the individual wells, but the companies that owned all the wells never seemed to generate any cash.
So their cost of production would be much higher than we'd see in the Middle East, would it?
Exactly. Now, each time there was an oil price crash, two things happened. One, these Irish American guys that were drilling in places like North Dakota stopped drilling in the more marginal fields. Before, they'd been paying ranchers about $1 billion per acre. Now they negotiated maybe $10,000 an acre. Some of them went bust. And in the United States, when companies go bust, they don't die. They're zombies. They come back to life. And you and I go over there and we buy a $1 billion company for $100 and we start again. Only this time, we've got a tiny capital cost rather than a big capital cost. Or in some cases, they sold their companies at a high price to BP or Equinor or Exxon or Chevron. And the major companies get tired of protesters at their AGM and they sell the companies to us at a knockdown price. So we come in at a very low price, cutting corners. We hire labor that's now available more cheaply than it was before. And suddenly our costs, our break even goes from $80 to maybe $40 and in the short run, even lower. Now, there's a limit, even in the United States, there's a limit to how far you can push that because for a short period, I can go to my mate Chuck around the corner and Chuck has a drilling rig. And I say, Chuck, you got to pay the bank. Guess what? I won't pay you $250,000 a day, but I'll pay you $50,000 a day. And Chuck will take that $50,000 a day because his variable cost may only be $40,000 a day. So he's getting $10,000 a day, but that doesn't last forever. 2 years into the drilling, he suddenly finds that his generator breaks down or the rig needs a safety check. And now he's got to either scrap the rig or charge me not quite $250,000 a day, but maybe $150,000 a day. So over time, the market does work. And the Americans will be able and have been able to claw back some of that production, but not in the really crazy fields, not fracking up in Alaska or fracking in really low yield areas, but fracking in the big, fat, generous reservoirs like the big Permian in Texas.
Do you think they'll achieve self-sufficiency now?
No, self-sufficiency is impossible for two reasons. One, because most of the fracked oil is actually very light, high-quality oil, whereas the American refiners are set up to burn crap. So basically, America has cheap cost of capital, but high labor and high environmental controls. So what the Americans did was they invested in super technology to use very dirty, sulfurous, heavy oil from Venezuela and Mexico. And if the oil price is, say, $73 like today, they can buy that crap for maybe $40. And because they've already invested in all the capital and technology, they can make good money making products like diesel and jet fuel out of the crap feedstock. But the good quality fracked crude that's produced by the Americans doesn't get a ready market in the United States. So what they do is they export that to relatively unsophisticated parts of the world, like Southeast Asia or Latin America. So the United States will always be dependent on imports.
Yeah, the refineries basically are elsewhere, basically for it. Last thing I want to do, Dave, before I let you go, is talk to you a bit more about Ireland. And you mentioned it earlier, basically we're banning new oil and gas exploration here, although the licenses that are in train at the moment are going to be allowed to continue to their natural conclusion. So what is your assessment, David? I mean, is there any chance we'll have another find, or are people just saying, do you know what, that's the end of it?
No, Ireland is a frontier province. Now, Ireland has a real potential. Like, we spent about $50 million with our partner doing state-of-the-art 3D seismic. We found some very interesting plays. We were planning to drill one or two of them. And then Leo Varadkar made a speech at the General Assembly in September 2019. And overnight, we decided we were out of Ireland. We were also in negotiations with a very, very large national gas company that was about to come into new blocks in the Porcupine Basin. And literally overnight.
That's off the coast of Kerry and Clare, the Porcupine Basin.
Yeah, I mean, the one that we were farming out to the new national oil corporation was in the northwest of Porcupine Basin, about 200 kilometers off the Cork-Kerry border. And the other blocks were in the east and the south of the Porcupine Basin. Yeah, probably multi-billion barrel potential. Now, it is in deep water. It is expensive. The safety standards are super high in European waters, so relatively costly. But overnight, it became impossible. And then you had these silly comments like, oh, we'll let you develop gas, but not oil. But at least 70% of the value from a reservoir is in the liquids, not in the gas. So effectively, they expropriated us. And that simply made it impossible for us to continue. And once trust is blown, it's a bit like your spouse finding you cheating. Once she's found you cheating once, she never really believes you when you say you're out with the boys. And that's what the Irish government did. Now, so far, it's only affected oil and gas. But it's only a matter of time before the Pfizers and the Intels and the Googles begin to realize that Ireland is not such a friendly home for some capitalist businesses.
I don't know about that. I mean, it's totally different, though. I mean, I think, you know, their heart is in the right place. They're doing it for climate change reasons. We're talking about totally different industries here.
Yeah, but their heart isn't in the right place, because if they worked it out that banning local production of gas and oil in Ireland only leads to it being imported from Western Siberia, which increases the carbon footprint by about a third. So their heart wasn't in the right place. The politicians wanted to signal virtue, but they didn't do what their advisors in the department had told them to do. And had they done so, they would have reduced our carbon footprint. So they weren't just hypocrites. They were foolish hypocrites.
Okay, we leave it there. David Horgan, Managing Director of Petrol Resources. Very interesting stuff. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks again.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.